141, Business Combination, and 142, Goodwill and Other Intangible Assets. That March, Eisner and I had our dinner at Nobu in Manhattan, where we discussed my writing this book and touched briefly on Eisner's life and career. At the time, I knew little about the tempest that was brewing in the Disney boardroom or the events leading up to it. Eisner didn't volunteer anything about it, though surely it was on his mind. Just weeks later, in Denver, Disney's board was scheduled to hold its first annual meeting since Gold and Roy opened their campaign for a management review. Both were planning to attend the meeting and confront Eisner with more tough questions. But the night before the meeting, Denver was blanketed by a snowstorm, and only a handful of shareholders arrived for the meeting. Neither Gold nor Roy could make it, nor could most of the board members. Instead, Disney directors met by phone. Items on the agenda included Disney's relationship to Miramax founders Harvey and Bob Weinstein, and the ongoing negotiations with Pixar. No action on Miramax was proposed, but directors reviewed a net present value analysis of Miramax prepared by Strategic Planning that suggested Miramax wasn't making any money. Groundwork was obviously being laid to get rid of the Weinsteins, or at least sharply reduce their compensation. Pixar continued to be a thorn in Eisner's side, and was now demanding a new deal in which they would receive as much as 92% of the profits, and Disney a small 8-12% as a distribution fee, with numerous other issues still unresolved, including the fate of the two films Pixar still owed under the current arrangement. Eisner warned that the terms being proposed were so onerous that it might not make sense for Disney to continue the relationship, especially if it had to give up profits on Pixar's next two films. Eisner also posited a theory that all creative streaks in the movie business come to an end eventually, as Disney's had in animation after Walt's death, before reviving under Eisner, Katzenberg, and Roy. Pixar's string of hits was defying the odds, and Pixar was headed for a fall, he predicted, as he had warned in the email about Finding Nemo. Maybe then Jobs would be more reasonable. Eisner told the board that he was hopeful a new deal could be worked out. Even Gold and Roy had to concede that the new terms being proposed by Pixar were onerous. But Gold argued that Eisner was to blame for letting such a successful partnership reach this juncture. While he hadn't talked to Jobs himself, he knew from Roy that it was Jobs's distrust and personal antipathy toward Eisner that were the root of the problem. "Forget the terms of what was or could be," Gold told Eisner and the board. "This is bad management. It's abysmal that we're fighting with a creative content partner. And it's abysmal that you've allowed this relationship to deteriorate." "It's impossible to negotiate with Steve Jobs. Jobs is a Shiite Muslim," Eisner blurted out, at which point Gold started to raise his voice. Mitchell had to step in to quell the dissension. In the wake of this exchange, Eisner began testing a radical new idea with other Disney executives and confidants: force Roy off the board. At least some who heard the idea were dumbfounded. Roy was the largest individual shareholder, the vice chairman of the company that bore his name. He was still the face of Disney to much of the public, a direct link to Walt, and immense